The August Coup by Robert Service, read by Leighton Pugh. Author's Note. I have ordinarily used the word union to refer to USSR-level officials and institutions. For the RSFSR, its officials and institutions, I have preferred Russian and Russia in the interest of demystification. Places are given their names as designated on the maps used in the Soviet time. So I use Belarusia rather than Belarus, and Kiev rather than Kiev. I have plumped for UNESCO's English rendering of Belovezha for the forest, where, on the 8th of December 1991, the decision was taken to break up the USSR. Apologies for any offence to national sensibilities. Transliteration is provided according to a simplified version of the US Library of Congress system. Introduction. The August 1991 coup against USSR President Mikhail Gorbachev was a firework that petered out after 3 days. Although its leaders were arrested, the result was the utter destabilization of the old Soviet order. Anti-communist organizations suddenly no longer needed to fear the KGB, the Soviet Army, or the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Gorbachev had already hollowed out central political power and undermined the communist state system. Boris Yeltsin and the leadership of Russia, which was the largest of the USSR's Soviet republics, were not alone in taking advantage of the situation. By early December that year, Yeltsin was meeting Ukraine's Leonid Kravchuk and Belarus's Stanislav Shushkevich in the Belovezha forest near the Polish border and signing an accord to found the Commonwealth of Independent States. The decision was confirmed the same month in the Alma-Ata Declaration. The USSR was no more. I went to Moscow on a scheduled research trip 4 weeks after the coup. Working at the London School of Slavonic and East European Studies, I had to deal with some questions about our exchange arrangement with the USSR Academy of Sciences. As usual, I phoned to set up a session at the Institute of USSR History. My contact there surprised me by saying, "Robert, it's okay. We don't need a meeting. We can talk freely over the phone. Nobody is afraid of anyone listening in to us now." Quite a turnaround, and there was more to come. The Central Party Archive off Gorky Street wanted to show that things had changed by inviting Professor R.W. Davis and me to be the first foreigners to enter the building on the morning it was unsealed after the coup. It had been a sanctum of the recently suspended Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and we were allowed to call for files of documents on topics that had always been forbidden to us. The archive's new director encouraged me to chat to the elderly senior archivist who oversaw the hallowed Lenin materials. So terrified was the archivist by the idea of encountering someone who did not share his adulation of the USSR's founder that he fled the premises and vanished for the duration of my Moscow stay. That was also the day when a prominent Soviet historian told me on our walk back to the metro station about the need to rewrite school textbooks. The October 1917 revolution had to be unconditionally denounced, he now stated, but blame had to be directed at those responsible for the misfortunes that subsequently afflicted the Russian people. Curiously, he levelled his loudest accusations not at anyone in revolutionary Russia, but at the British coalition government. He blamed Prime Minister David Lloyd George for consigning Russians to the horrors of Stalinism by denying enough aid to the White Armies in the Civil War. Next day at the archive, in a calmer exchange, I was asked whether the UK's records held anything about the father of KGB Major General Viktor Karpukhin, who had disobeyed orders to attack the Russian White House in the August coup. There was now a project to lionize Karpukhin Jr. as a hero, in the way that communist leaders had previously been treated. For the record, I had never heard of Karpukhin Sr. Muscovite